Okay, well, one of the great difficulties about actually being a pastor is when you go away to preach is the older I get, the more I realise is that you're frightened. It's just a one-off. There's so much that you want to say, and there's so little time to say it. And we are going to parachute in to 1 Samuel. And we're going to parachute in to probably one of the most darkest parts of the book. Now, I don't want you to think in any way that I'm kind of some sort of morbid kind of Christian, not at all. I want to parachute in there because I think it's got incredible valuable lessons to teach us today. So I want to spend today with you in Samuel 4, 5 and 6. And this morning, particularly in 1 Samuel 4. Now, because we're going to parachute in there, can I just do two things? Just two things quickly, just kind of by pre-introduction, if you like, to get us to just get our mindset a little bit around the book and where we are. Let me do that by asking two questions. One, where exactly are we on this journey of biblical revelation? And I think I'd answer that simply in this way. It's the best way. It's the way that so often those with a reformed mindset approach the whole matter of biblical revelation, the revelation of God in Jesus Christ. And it's this: if, as we have seen so far, God's prophet Moses has begun to speak God's word and spoke of a prophet to come, and in doing that he has initiated God's priesthood, whereby God's people can approach the God who has spoken. So now we're going to begin to learn about God's king. Prophet, priest, king. So as we come to 1 and 2 Samuel, what are we doing? Well, we stopped here. What are we actually doing? What's the book all about? Well, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, obviously, is the book of the kingdom. How God establishes his kingdom. And it's a book of how God establishes his kingdom by bringing forth to his people his chosen king. In many ways, 1 Samuel particularly is the book of the king. Samuel the king maker, Saul the king failure, David the ideal king. But in doing that, we need to see that what the writer is about as he talks and as he tells us the story of God's kingdom and God's king coming, that king, if you like, with a small lowercase k, is all about looking forward and in type announcing God's king with a capital K, King Jesus. So that's kind of just quickly where we're coming to. So we come this morning to look into the events of Chapter 4. Now, I always think it's helpful when you come to an incident like this to kind of take a handle to get a hold of it. And the handle I give you is simply a title. If you want to give a title to what's happening here, I want to call it Day of Days. Day of Days. If I said to you, for instance, October the 29th, I've got it written down here, so I'm clever. Tuesday, October the 29th, 1929. You think, well, if you know about history, you know it was a day of when, if you like, the stock markets collapsed in the US. If I mention kind of Wednesday, September the 16th, 1992, you think it's a day of days. It was a day when the pound went under here in the UK. We talk about 9/11. There are days, and there are days of days. Days when it seems, to borrow a phrase, the sky seems to be falling down on top of us. That's true in the lives of nations, as we're going to see here.
It's true in the life of us as individuals. And if we really want to get a hold of in terms of what was happening here, we need to clearly understand that here is a story about God establishing his kingdom amongst his people. The Lord of Hosts, that's so important. You'll find that that's the first time that name is used of God in the Bible, in this book. Hannah introduced it, and it's used several times throughout. The sovereign God of all things. And suddenly we find a day when this God's people seem to be utterly, utterly obliterated. And the impact is that here is the great covenant God of Revelation who has called a people, and the God of that people now found themselves not just floundering, but clearly utterly failing. In many ways, the chapter's a little bit, if you like it, put it this way, it's X-rated spirituality. Why? Because it's dealing with what happens when God's people fail. What happens when God's people fail? And that isn't something that it's sobering, it's realistic. It's not meant to be something that makes us moribund at all, but it is meant to be something that makes us think about our relationship with this God and what it means to be his people. So, what happens when the church fails? Why does it happen? Well, let me bring four things to you this morning, okay? Four simple lessons from this passage. First of all, let's come and look at those opening two verses. Verses 1 and 2. God's people fail when they try to make progress without God. God's people fail when they try to make progress without God. Now, that seems almost, so obvious that you think, well, how can God's people do that? But I would say to you, if I may be so bold, just simply think about your own Christian life. And consider the times in which, as you reflect, you realised you've tried to make progress in the Christian life and you've not done it. And when you evaluate, it's probably because you tried to make progress without God. What's the circumstances? Well, here we are. There is this conflict that was so, for them, was almost a matter of every day. That as a nation that's gradually been established and growing, and the growing pains of other nations around it, they're confronted with the Philistines. It's interesting, isn't it, that even today, outside the Christian church, people often use that phrase, you know, when they want to suggest that someone's a little bit kind of barbaric or not kind of yapping in with things. You are Philistine. That is such a misnomer for this reason. Because in their day and age, and where we are looking at this morning, they were so technologically advanced, military-wise. They were so the power brokers of that region, of that time, that the very fact that they come back into the story of the Israelites time and time and time again until David finally, in the grace and mercy of God, brings that kind of part of their history of the nation to an end, it sounds to you that here is God's people facing a very real, aggressive, technically sound enemy. People who had one aim in mind. They wanted land. They wanted land to grow. And they wanted to defeat those who they saw as their enemies. But here, this is God's people. Why should they be worried?
But what the writer does is you look into these first two verses and he describes how there's this opening skirmish and the Israelites are defeated and some 3,000 men are lost. He's actually saying to you and I, as he so often does in the book, it's wonderful, and look at the way he writes a book, it's a great object lesson in itself. There's a little ahem in the kind of opening two verses. Do you know what it is? Because you've got this description of this initial conflict, this battle and this defeat. But look how it begins. It says, "Now the word of Samuel came to all Israel." That's kind of the summary of the previous chapter's event, where finally God has established a prophetic, authoritative voice to God's people of that day. And the point the writer is making simply here is this: that the reason why God's people failed to make progress at this particular juncture is that they were choosing to do so without listening or taking heed to the word that God was speaking to them. There is in many ways a terrifying scenario in 1 Samuel 4, 5 and 6. And do you know what it is? It's the absence of the presence of God amongst his people. God's spoken about, God's referred to, God's name is used, but he's the unknown God. He's a God to whom his own people, we'll look at some of the reasons why, have for all sorts of reasons chosen to, can I put it this way, to copper deafen, to shut their ears, to listen to what he is actually saying. God's people fail to make progress when they seek to do so without God. I think we could sum it up in this way. As Christians, we need to learn here, this lesson. We cannot ultimately expect to make progress in the Christian life if we choose to ignore the recognized ministries that God has given to us as his people. It's a very simple lesson. It's a very sound lesson. But it's a lesson that lies at the heart of healthy Christian living. Here are people failing. And the writer's inference is because they weren't listening to what God was saying. That's the first thing. Second thing we look at there, it comes out in verses 3 to 9. And that's simply this: God's people fail when they asked the right question, but fail to find the right answer. Here's the Israelites facing a dilemma. How can we be defeated? How can it be we're the people of God, and how can it possibly be that we're now on the back foot? And the story goes that they suddenly make this kind of it's obvious to them, this obvious kind of conclusion. Well, look, they say, why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Right question to ask. Why have we failed? Look at the answer. Let us bring up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from Shiloh. Right question to ask, wrong answer to find. You see, one of the things that is coming out to us here is that when God's people find themselves in this sort of situation, they rightly find themselves having to ask questions.
Why are we in this situation? And a great temptation sometimes is to try and find an answer which seems so logical but isn't biblical or spiritual. You see, the ark for them was what? It was that great symbol of the very presence of God. And the thinking is that because the ark physically is not amongst us, God's presence is not amongst us. You see, there's a very real subtlety, but you see what the subtlety is, don't you? And the subtlety is this, isn't it? That they're assuming that somehow God's presence will automatically be found amongst them to bring success simply by them going through the motions. Well, if the ark is a symbol of God's presence, and that's what God has said, then we need the ark to be with us where we are, and if the ark's with us where we are, then we'll find success. The problem with that was this. It was a misguided assumption, because it was based on willful ignorance. And the willful ignorance was this, that God made it quite clear, if you go back and you look into Deuteronomy 12, that God had spoken through Moses, and God had made it quite clear that the ark was not to be removed. The ark was to be in its place. It was God's footstool. It was his temporary earthly abode of the... It was a temporary earthly abode of the God of heaven. He was there, of course. But he wasn't contained there alone. It's slightly ironic, really, that the ark, the symbol of God's presence, contained what? The Ten Commandments. The Word of God. And the irony, of course, is it's because they're ignoring the Word of God that they're in this situation. And yet, this kind of corporate insanity, I'd call it, comes over them. That somehow, led by the elders, interestingly enough, led by the leadership, somehow they think that they're able to control the God who they call, who has made himself known to them as the Lord of hosts. Somehow, we've got the ark, if we bring it to us, God comes to us where we are. There is no ex opera operato with the God of grace. The issue here was that here was a people who had totally forgotten that without faith it's impossible to please God. Here were people who were so reliant on the external, outward, can I bring it into a New Testament framework, means of grace, that somehow the very means of grace they thought meant that God was in their pocket. And that's always a very difficult corner for God's people to be in, because there's a fog of superstition descends upon them, isn't it? It's a little almost, I don't want to kind of trivialise this, but it's almost like that old fashioned song, isn't it? Elvis song about my lucky charm. It's that sort of mentality. This is our lucky charm. And brethren, why is it there? Because it's saying to you and I, as God's people, that in subtle ways we can sometimes be like that in our thinking about the Christian life. I think you could sum it up by saying this as we close the second point. No amount of activity or in geniusness can replace a faith that is conscious of its relationship with God. The writer explains that what they thought was going to happen, the actual reverse happens. That the ark comes in, they raise this huge shout, and it has this adverse effect. It rebounds. The Philistines hear it, and they know it's the ark, and it kind of it stirs them up, and we're led into this catastrophe that actually comes about in verses 10 to 20, where the writer relates this devastating defeat, where 30,000 Israelites are slain. That brings to the third thing then about this lesson. God's people's failure sometimes leads to calamitous events. And here was a day that I think that if you'd asked any contemporary Israelite of the day, of that time, could this possibly happen? I think they would have thought it impossible. A couple of years back, I love history, and a couple of years back, we were able just to feel something I'd always wanted to do, which was to stand on the beaches of Normandy, where the D-Day landings took place. If you know anything about that kind of period of history, you know that one of the things that was often said about it is that people thought that day would never, never come. That day would never come when, Fortress Europe would be opened up, as it were, and the Allies would be able to cross that 23-mile strip of the Channel. And I suspect that any Israelite would have thought that this would have been an impossible day when God's people are not just rebuffed by God's enemies, but are defeated so wholeheartedly that 30,000 are slain, the priesthood is wiped out in Hophni and Phinehas, the ark is captured, the very presence, the symbol of the very presence of God is taken away. God's people are absolutely bereft. You've got to ask the question, haven't you, Charlie? Does God live? Is he alive? Can his people possibly be found in such a situation like this? Well, there's some things to learn, aren't there? God is still alive. He is still at work, even in such circumstances. You and I need to pick up a couple of things. Look at the way in which the writer, look at verse 11. Here's the writer, and he just tells these events almost, just as a kind of little add-on, but they're catastrophic. The ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. Notice what's happening. What's happening is this, that here is, I'll put it this way, a very quiet but very remarkable evidence of God's judgment. Here were two men who had so abused the privileges that God had given to them, had so chosen to ignore that living faith in the living God, had so thought that God was a God that they just put up and put down and put in their pocket as they pleased, that God had said, actually, that's it, I've had enough. He had already announced to Eli that his two sons would be taken from him. And in no kind of, not without a blast of trumpet, no kind of, big opening the curtains, just suddenly in the course of things, the writer says, in this rout that took place, these two men lose their life. The judgment of God is always certain. It might not always be in blazing lights, but it's inevitable, it's inscrutable. and it occurs. And the ark is captured. And if it doesn't end there, Eli is so distraught on hearing the news. And notice the depth of the man's spirituality. Don't misunderstand him. He's not some kind of father who's really lost it, you know, some kind of psychopath. Here's a man who understood that with the pain of his sons, losing his sons, the real issue was the fact, as he understood what God was saying, as he allowed the ark to be taken. And Eli, we're told, due to his age and infirmity, falls off this seat he's on and passes away. And it's not just Eli, that Eli's daughter-in-law loses her life in childbirth. It's almost as the writer says, you know, it's a catalogue of one kind of calamity after another, all kind of being rushed up together. It's the end of an era. The writer's going to make clear to you, because from this moment, the ark no longer resides at Shiloh. The worship of God's people is no longer centered at Shiloh. It moves around until it's finally settled again in Jerusalem. What's a lesson? Isn't it this? That God is more serious about our keeping real, living, loving, vibrant relationships with him than we are. There is nothing in one respect automatic in the Christian life. And the great lesson that cries out from this failure is that God's people should not expect God's presence and power if they're not prepared to live holy lives. That's a message that is not very popular necessarily in the church today, but it's a message that needs to be heard. But that brings me to a fourth and final thing. On such a day like we're looking at, on such a day of days, I want to say to you fourthly this. God's people need to be wary about making a hasty assessment on such days. The chapter ends with this sad picture of the wife of Phineas dying in childbirth. And this is real pathos in the story, isn't it? That there she is, and you can imagine, you know, I mean, we're so used to all our, thank God, our modern medical advances. The danger of childbirth is in so many ways for us, you know, it's so kind of, it's hedged about in so many ways today, isn't it? And here's this poor woman without any benefit of that, expiring in childbirth. But before she does, having heard the news, and you can imagine the poor woman, all she's going through, and she hears the news of the defeat, she hears the news of her husband. In many ways, if you look back in history, that was a blessing for her, because he'd been such a toe rag towards her anyway. Her father-in-law, and you can almost understand as the child comes forth, she gives the child this name, Ichabod. Inglorious. The glory of God has departed. And that is, of course, in one sense, a very understandable assessment of the situation, isn't it? It's very understandable for her from where she was and what was occurring for her to say, well, that's it. Really, God's people are in such a disarray that the glory of God has gone. It's very easy in one sense, isn't it? To look around us in society. I mean, come on, let's be honest. Look at us here this morning. What are we here this morning? 40? 50? I don't know about you, but as I look, I think about that, and I think about who I am, and I think about how inadequate I am, and what a motley crew we look at as Christians. And what's our percentage in a community like this? Or look around the state of the church. It's very easy, isn't it, to think the glory has departed. But isn't the issue here this? And in many ways, that's why I want to go into chapter 5 and 6. Because chapter 5 and 6, kind of, the writer kind of stands up and shouts this out loud, it seems to me. Because it's the antidote to what we're reading here, ultimately. And he shouts out this. When God's people fail, when calamitous days come to God's people, we are never, and let's underline that word never with capital letters, we are never to think or even begin to imagine that because God's people have failed, God is therefore a failure. That's a great lesson that shouts out now. And there's this rather hasty assessment that she makes of the circumstances, while in many ways, in one level being true, on another level it clearly isn't. There could well be someone here this morning, a Christian. Let me put it to you this way, make an application. And you might be a moment being kind of doing one of those things that sometimes we do, not always helpful, as we do it, evaluating your life, your Christian life. And you may be looking around, you think, oh gosh, I really failed there. I really screwed up out there. I've really let someone down. And you're looking around, and there seems to be all around you the debris of failure. And I don't want in any way to say that that may not be true. But what I do want to say to you, that through the grace of God's wonderful, wonderful mercy in Jesus Christ, our failure never makes God a failure. In one respect, isn't the heart of the message of God's revelation the truth that He is a God who specializes in reversing reverses? Would there not yet come another day of days, another day to surpass all days, when seemingly everything in hell, even including the kitchen sink, was thrown at that wonderful King Jesus on the cross? Wasn't it such a truth that seemingly everything came at him, and at that very moment, in his utter weakness, surrounded by jeering and mocking and spitting and being called all sorts of names, seemingly when he expired, saying, "It is finished," in seeming utter weakness. It's all fouled. It's all come to nothing. Isn't that when God's grace and glory and power was seen in its most pristine, its most eloquent? Isn't that the place where seemingly out of failure, the Lord of hosts brought the victory that would secure the victory of his people throughout all the ages? Yeah. It was true in one respect. Something of the glory of God had departed from Israel. But that did not mean that God's glory, that his own, was diminished. You and I need to go away encouraged this morning, encouraged why? Because only God deals with failures. Only God reverses faith. In one sense, couldn't you say this? This all came about. Why? Because these people really thought they weren't that. They really thought that somehow they weren't failures. And God is saying, actually, without me, that's all you ever have been, that's all you ever will be. But with me, let's put it in the New Testament, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us and gave himself for us.